marketing and managing tourism. It's a delicate balance. How do we ensure our number one economic driver doesn't trigger a pushback? The Hawaii Tourism Authority recently released results of a resident survey, and not surprisingly, with our record visitor numbers, resident satisfaction is slipping. Here's some feedback that you gave us about tourism across the state.
The visitor industry is keeping us from being creative. It's a 21st century nothing. We need to go into the hemp manufacturing, the cotton manufacturing. We can make clothes out of hemp made in Hawaii and cotton, blue jeans. We can retrain. We can educate our local kids and have a really sustainable society. But the tourism is not part of it. Maybe a little bit, but not like it is.
I think that rampant, massive tourism is entirely ruining Hawaii. I think that what has happened is that we have become homogenized with the mainland, and we have lost our own culture and the things that make Hawaii unique. Even though there has been an attempt to use Hawaiian values, I think that those have been overtaken by a cutesy approach to Hawaiian culture, and we've just lost where we're going. I think that there needs to be some kind of controls, some kinds of limitations. Our land is taken over, our neighborhoods are taken over, our beaches are taken over. Everything has become commercialized. What used to be public beaches are now full of chairs and canoes and other things that are specifically for the tourist, which local people certainly can't afford. So I just believe that tourism is a bad deal.
That was Gus from the Big Island and Dorothy from Maui. We sat down with HTA's Jennifer Chun, who heads up the agency's tourism research division, to drill down on the numbers to try and understand what's happening.
The study was first initiated in 1988, so it kind of does go back for a while, but we've been doing it more frequently recently because they were doing it more periodically, and we now have moved it so it's an annual survey instead of every other year or less frequently, and we are seeing that trend where everybody recognizes the value of tourism. That was kind of an issue like in the early 90s where people didn't recognize that tourism was our number one industry and it was the economic driver. But now everybody gets it. People understand that, you know, tourism brings in a lot of jobs. You know, we have the opportunity to have festivals and events and shopping. And everybody acknowledges that. But now it's kind of this issue where, you know, where is the balance between what the residents need and what the visitors need? So I think people are still happy to have visitors come, but it's affecting their lives in different ways because visitors are traveling differently too. So it wasn't so much that, you know, you could go into every neighborhood and see visitors. People kind of stuck to like Waikiki and the beaches, and they would go to the Polynesian Cultural Center, and people are still doing those things, but as social media is prompting people, you see them in unusual places for, you know, for us as residents. And so that's kind of prompting some of this where, you know, maybe that's a negative for me and that, you know, what are the benefits for tourism? We get that. But now we're starting to have some impacts in my life that, you know, maybe might not be so positive.
Right. And we have seen the proliferation of illegal vacation rentals outside of the areas where they were supposed to be operating when this whole thing was set up years ago.
Yes. And actually, and we see that more on Oahu because there's not currently a mechanism to become a license or get that variance. You know, we see in other counties, like, for example, in Maui County or on Kauai, that they have systems set up and there is, you know, some method where they evaluate your application and everything like that. And I know that County of Hawaii would also like to do something. And with, you know, with the mayor's stated intentions of what he wants to do for vacation rentals, you know, I think that's a step that they're at least moving because the city and county of Honolulu hadn't moved in quite a while on this issue. They had no changes in the list of approved units since 1989. I mean, 1989.
Right. Yeah. Here in Honolulu. Yeah. And it's there's a lot of
changes. Yeah. So, of course, it means that a lot of the people are not in, you know, up to in the zoning that they're supposed to be in. So, of course, there's a lot more that they're going to have to address. Like, for each of those units. And like you said, it's in every neighborhood.
So tell us more about the survey.
People were contacted primarily by phone, and it's historically been a phone survey. But this time around, we tried to do something a little bit different and to see if we contacted people online, whether or not that would affect the results of the survey. And, you know, we did a test with that, and we feel that those results are equal, you know, the results came out similarly. So going forward, I think that will enable us to reach to more people, because with the switch where people are canceling their landlines and people not necessarily, like, answering cell phones from people, it's harder to get people on the phone. So if somebody will take an online survey, we can have bigger reach.
Okay. And the upshot of the survey, how much of a difference are we seeing from the last time, just about the negative reaction?
I think that it's a little bit more negative on some things. So there's three tracking questions that we've been looking at since 1988 is about the impact of tourism on you and your family. Has it been positive? And that we did see that go up, so that's great. You know, we also have a question about, is this island run, you know, for tourists at expense of local people? And we also saw that gradually go up. And then whether or not tourism brings more benefits than problems, you know, we see that going down. But it's not dramatically going down. We saw a bigger shift earlier in the survey period from 2010 to 2012. But in the most recent rounds of the survey, the shifts have been more gradual.
Okay, but the whole point of this mm-hmm. is to help us better manage our numbers, I guess, and just to get feedback.
Absolutely. So this is an important tool, not only for the Hawaii Tourism Authority, but, you know, for the state in general, because knowing how residents feel about tourism, no one else really does a survey like this. In fact, when I talk to other destinations around the country, you know, they would like to do a survey of their residents to see how they feel about tourism. So I feel like with this tool, people can, you know, decide how their budgets are going and how their program strategies. And, you know, knowing that this has been a trend, Hawaii Tourism Authority really has been doing a lot of programs that maybe people don't know about. We have a lot of community programs. We have a lot of programs that support natural resources and Hawaiian culture. And, I mean, people tend to know about the festivals and events that we support, but the other things that are more quiet activities, people might not know that HTA supports, and we really are doing a lot on every island.
I was at an event recently, the mm-hmm. wearable art, and that was in Waikiki.
Mm-hmm.
Different venue, I think, and I think maybe the idea was to bring in visitors, because already a large cross-section of the local residents mm-hmm. attend that show.
But in making things, like, for example, for that event, one of the reasons why Hawaii Tourism Authority will sponsor is, of course, because there is a visitor component for that. But we do think that having events is important for residents. So if this is a resident-focused event that we can enhance with our sponsorship and then also bring in visitors, that's, you know, very compelling for HTA.
Okay. So what else can you share with this? I mean, I know I'm mm-hmm. looking at a page here in this report that folks were flagging the traffic problems and overcrowding, higher prices, damage to the environment. I mean, mm-hmm. pretty high up there.
Actually, yeah, those are the top negatives that people cited, because we asked them, for those people who said that tourism brings more benefits, more problems than benefits, kind of switching the question order around, you know, we asked them, what are those problems? And, you know, those are the ones that rose to the top about traffic, overcrowding, and the cost of living. One of the things that we did note is that, well, okay, so we see this trend for traffic and overcrowding, and it's definitely as the number of visitors go up, people have more of that feeling that it's too crowded, that there's more traffic. But at the same time, we're looking at the resident population and seeing how the resident population is growing too. So not only are there more visitors here on a daily basis, but just us who live here. So, you know, the islands are only so large. And so that it's like balancing out the needs of everyone. Because it's not like you can magically tell some airline, okay, you know what, you can't bring as many people on that flight. You know, that's not how it works.
Yeah, can't put a lid on it.
No, not really.
Although there were attempts, I think, with bills at the legislature. But impractical, but mm-hmm. at least it gets the conversation going.
Yes, nobody's putting their head in the sand, you know what I mean? So we like to have these conversations with, you know, the community, with our stakeholders, and just understand how we can, HCA can impact the greater communities. So, for example, we do have a meeting with, like, the mayor's office and, you know, his staff on a quarterly basis. And we talk to them about, you know, for Honolulu City and County in particular, what are the issues and how can we get involved? Because we recognize that visitors are impacting, you know, the county. So that's something that I think has been a good dialogue and something that HTA has been doing for, I think, 5 or 6 years.
Right, because we're talking about impact on the city services, whether it's a rescue mm-hmm. on a hiking trail or, you know, an unfortunate incident at our beaches.
Yes. And I think that, you know, those, unfortunately, I don't know if it's more public now or if it's just that more people are having issues. I think that people are underestimating their ability to, you know, go snorkeling and, you know, are they in the best of health? And, you know, they're not used to, like, swimming in the ocean versus swimming in a lake. I mean, there are a lot of different factors. So we hope that, you know, HCA can help the visitors in general by getting the message out, how be responsible for yourself while you're traveling and, you know, knowing your limits and don't go into dangerous areas, those kinds of things.
Right. We want to keep everybody safe.
Yeah, exactly. It's really important. Our residents too.
Anything else that you think would be important to underscore with the survey that you folks did?
I think that one of the things that has improved over time, I think that residents have recognized the importance of representing the Hawaiian culture in an authentic manner, you know, like, because what makes Hawaii different from any other destination, because, you know, other destinations have nice beaches and nice trails and things like that, but it really is our people, our place, our culture, and that whole, you know, Hawaiian culture is the underpinning of everything. And, you know, we have been making strides working with people, you know, how they're using the Hawaiian culture in their marketing or, you know, in their attractions. And I think that we've seen that, you know, the acknowledgement of that's increased. That's great.
And then anything distinctive from the various neighbor islands at all?
One of the things that's interesting, and I don't have a deeper insight to it, but we did see that there's less unhappiness with the tourism industry on Kauai. So I think that maybe they, you know, every island understands the importance, but maybe because of the way their traffic patterns are or where their hotels are located.
Fewer complaints.
Yeah, fewer complaints. So, but it seems that, you know, every island is feeling it.
We saw the downturn on the Big Island mm-hmm. quickly after the volcano news kind of hit the world. Mm-hmm. Have you done any surveys since then?
No, but planning to go into the field by the end of next month to do another round of surveys. So if you're listening and you get a call, please respond to the survey. We want to know what everybody in the States thinks. But, you know, we are planning to, you know, monitor how people feel about tourism, you know, on an ongoing basis going forward. So it will be interesting to see if the volcanic activity on the island of Hawaii has any impact on how residents feel about tourism. You know, we certainly know how the businesses feel. So it would be good to know how people who are not necessarily in the industry feel about it.
Right. But we did see a drop off and it is affecting jobs.
Absolutely.
Anything else?
If you do attend a sponsored event, event sponsored by Hawaii Tourism Authority, we are making a bigger effort this year to have evaluation staff. So, you know, you'll see people offering to take a survey about the event. And one of the things that we look at is not only the economic impact and how satisfied people are with the event itself, but we are also looking at the community impact of all of these events that we're sponsoring. And so, you know, if you are attending an event and you're approached by staff, you know, please kokua and, you know, take our survey. I think the most important thing is that, you know, we do recognize that the residents are definitely more concerned, that we have to focus more on managing the destination. And I think that HTA has responded to that. And I think that HTA hasn't done a good job of telling people that we're doing those things necessarily. And so I think it's, you know, on us to tell people about things that we're doing so that they're aware, not just for the sake of them being aware that, you know, oh, yay, HTA, but the fact that we are doing things and that we are looking to balance things out and help the communities. You know, we do weight the data. So if we tend to, we try and oversample a little bit, maybe on the neighbor islands because, you know, of the population, but everything goes back to census data and it's weighted for geographic distribution and everything. So we do feel that the survey is a good representative of the overall opinions of the residents of the state and by island.
That was HTA's Jennifer Chun, Director of Tourism Research, talking about recent survey results as we try to strike a balance between the needs of residents and the needs of visitors. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the Hawaii Power Ballot makes voting quick and easy. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we take you over the Pali and into Nu'uanu Valley to the Queen Emma Summer Palace. Now a museum, the stately home once served as the summer home of Queen Emma, consort to King Kamehameha IV. The frame of the mansion was assembled first in Boston before being sailed around Cape Horn and landing on Oahu's shores in 1848. Upon completion, the palace boasted 6 rooms, a large porch, and a series of Doric columns built in the Greek Revival style. In 1857, the house and property was purchased by John Keone Ana Young and given as a gift to the future Queen Emma. Situated upon a 5-acre plot that boasted a number of native Hawaiian plants, there were plans at one point to build a baseball field over the site. This drastic repurposing would have gone through to if not for the efforts of the Daughters of the of Hawaii Society, who ceded the property and operate the museum on its grounds to this day. While its common name is well known enough, in today's Backyard Quiz, we're asking listeners to tell us the Hawaiian name of the Queen Emma Summer Palace. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. Thomas Square in Honolulu. You probably drive by often, but do you know its history? Tomorrow, the city plans to unveil a statue of King Kalakaua at the Urban Park. It's to mark Sovereignty Restoration Day. The park is named after a British officer who flew the flag of the Hawaiian Kingdom back in the 1800s. But there was another ceremony held yesterday by some Hawaiian groups in a nod to what was established as a national holiday in 1843. Our Kuvei Hirashi was there and joins us in the studio this morning to talk about why we have two ceremonies. What's up with that?
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So yesterday, I think it was just in big part because it was a weekend. There was the La Hoihoi'ea or Restoration, Sovereignty Restoration Day celebration held yesterday, but the official holiday is actually July 31st.
Okay.
And this dates back to 1843, like you said, established by Kaua Keoli Kamehameha III. So what happened was a little bit of history. For 5 quick months in 1843, Hawaii, the Hawaiian Kingdom, was actually under British occupation. So Lord Paulette came in, kind of declared Hawaii for the crown, and back then, no no phones or no way to kind of get to Queen Victoria quick enough. So they sent envoys to check in to see, is this really what Queen Victoria wants? And that was not the case. So she sent back Admiral Thomas to come back to Hawaii to let the king know that, no, in fact, we are not taking over Hawaii. Sorry about that. And restored sovereignty. So what happens every year, and this is the 175th anniversary of this celebration, is people get together to kind of reenact that flag restoration ceremony. So they take down the Union Jack at Thomas Square and put up the Hawaiian flag. And we got to talk to one of the historians who's been involved in this Sovereignty Restoration Day celebration, Dr. Baron Ching, about what actually happened back in 1843.
And they had a ceremony where flag was restored, the king was restored, the constitution was restored. And the king declared that day to be a holiday called Lahoihoi'ea. He goes back to the steps at Kauaiha'o and he gives a speech, and part of that speech is Ua mau ke e o ka aini ka pono, which is not the life of the land, it is a sovereignty, because he said Ua mau ke e a not ke ola o ka aina I ka pono.
That's right. And a lot of history coming out of that one day. Like we said, the state motto was established that day, but also on that grounds, this was actually where Thomas Square is today, but it wasn't the case until Rear Admiral Thomas came to Hawaii and gave us back our sovereignty. So Dr. Ching kind of chimes in on what happened after that.
He declares that little piece of property out there, that dusty flat piece of whatever, to be Hawaii's first public park, to be named after Admiral Richard Thomas. It becomes Thomas Square. And the street motto of that is Britannia for Britannia. And the street on the Diamond Head side of that is Victoria for Queen Victoria of England.
And after this, I think a lot of what happened in the Hawaiian mindset was we needed to go out and seek resolutions and treaties with other countries to actually acknowledge Hawaii's place in the world as a kingdom, as a sovereign entity. And so that's what happened then. The king sent out envoys to France and to England to sort of start treaties that says, yes, we recognize Hawaii as an independent kingdom so that nobody comes in and tries to take our sovereignty again.
Right. So we had a rogue ruler for a while.
We did. And it was the same concept or the same sort of sequence of events that led to the overthrow as well. So they had a British subject in Hawaii saying, hey, British subjects aren't, you know, being treated well. Please come and help us. And that's what this turned into.
Okay. And then the city tomorrow will unveil the statue and you got a sneak peek?
I got a sneak peek. I think somebody sort of brought down the sheet that they've got over it, but it is huge and it's right at Thomas Square. So if anyone looks at Thomas Square by Google Maps or an aerial view, you'll actually see the Union Jack as the pathway along this place. But they've got the statue up. A lot of folks were kind of looking to see what it was about, but I think it'll be a good nod in the right direction in terms of acknowledging Hawaii's history.
Right, but so we have other statues of the king, but this is a little different.
This is, I think it's really commemorating this specific Lahoihoi'ea celebration because it had not been, it was celebrated up until the overthrow. So from 1843 through 1893, it was celebrated, but it stopped for a while and picked back up in the 80s and I think really took off these last 10 years. So I think this is a testament to that.
Okay, so it'll be really interesting. The next time I drive by, the statue will be there, the king will be there, and
you will
we'll
be
give a nod.
Exactly.
All right, thanks, Kuvei. That was Kuvei Hiraishi sharing an interesting piece of history with us, Sovereignty Restoration Day. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chaminade University, committed to strengthening the community's health with its MBA in Healthcare Administration, launching this fall. Chaminade.edu.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Jim Simon is the managing editor of the online news. And you're are you on that on the line there, Jim? Can you hear me?
I am, Catherine.
So you have a story about dental care in the state. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a story that was done by Anita Hofschneider, one of our reporters here, that really looks at the crisis situation for dental treatment for the poor in Hawaii, where there's really few options and little funding for low-income people who need everything, routine care from, you know, having your cavity filled or some sort of other treatment. And there's very few options for that. And that leads to a situation where many wind up seeking dental care in emergency rooms, which, of course, is the most expensive option by far. And as Anita found, the demand is really huge. She really discovered that by talking to folks in the long line outside of a Kalihi community clinic of folks who were seeking dental care, reduced price dental care at a community clinic that's available a few times a week. And she told the story, a really poignant story, I thought, but very typical story of a man named Lee who's on Medicaid, which in Hawaii does not cover dental care, who had this incredible tooth pain but was told it would cost him $1,500 for a reconstruction of his tooth. Really all he could afford, and the doctor sort of acknowledged that, was just to have his tooth pulled. And like a lot of folks, he actually turned to prayer to deal with the pain. And his quote kind of stuck with me. Is it worth paying $1,500? That's kind of a stupid question. But when you don't have the money, it's everything.
Wow. Yeah. And tooth pain is terrible pain.
Yeah. It's awful if you've ever had it.
Wow.
And I think one of the situations here is a decade ago, to put this in some context, in the middle of the recession, the state really cut all Medicaid funding for non-emergency adult dental care for adults. And so only in an emergency situation do you get funding if you're a Medicaid patient. And that really leaves Hawaii in the minority of states that don't really provide anything for routine coverage for adults. And it's really a funding issue, strictly. Advocates push the legislature to begin funding dental coverage again this year. The governor, Governor Ige, asked for about, I think, $11 million in combined federal and state funding. The head of the House Finance Committee, Sylvia Luke, blocked it. She argued the real cost of providing this care was more like $43 million, and that was just too expensive for the state. And the state has sort of waxed and waned in providing this kind of care, but really since 2009, it hasn't been available.
Now, I've often heard of stories where you have students who were studying to be dental hygienists, and they would look for patients to practice on. I mean, what about that service that might be available?
Well, I don't know so much about dental hygienists, but this problem is compounded by the fact that Hawaii doesn't have a dental school at all. So, you know, in many states, dentists, for example, dentists in training provide that kind of care. You know, people can go there and get cut-rate care. So the situation here is exacerbated by not having a dental school. And it's also exacerbated, I think, by another factor here. Hawaii does, unlike 75% of the nation, does not fluoridate its water.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
So, yeah. And, you know, there's kind of another double whamming that even where Medicaid funding is available for kids for dental care, very few dentists want to take it because the fees for Medicaid patients are so low.
Doesn't pay. All right. Thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. That was Honolulu Civil Beat Managing Editor Jim Simon with today's reality check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. what do hip-hop artists Jay Dilla, A Tribe Called Quest, and jazz greats Herbie Hancock and Miles Davis have in common? They'll all be featured on Friday, August 10th, when drummer Dehan and his ensemble take over the Atherton. Call 955-8821 during office hours or go to hprtickets.org for this genre-crossing evening. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management. It's not always easy to make informed decisions at the voting booth. Hawaii voters are often eligible, to cast a ballot in half a dozen separate races. Common Cause Hawaii thinks it's found a way to make it easier this year. The nonprofit says its Power Ballot makes it quick to get up to speed with good information before you vote. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty spoke with Corey Tanita of Common Cause to find out more.
It's a web-based application that one can use from a computer, their tablet, and their smartphone. And basically, you just put in your address that you registered with, and a mock-up of your ballot pops up. But this mock-up is interactive, so you can click on candidates' names, see a picture of them, and get connected to links to their website, social media pages, and candidate questionnaires.
And what races does it show?
All of them, as much information as we could find. Some folks, we couldn't find even a picture of some candidates, but as much as we could find, all of this information was sourced by our volunteers who took the time to look up each candidate for the whole state and try to find all of this important information, because we know it can be overwhelming.
And we should note that you still have to be registered to vote. You can't register through this website.
Not through this website. And the official deadline to register for the primary has passed, but it's important to note that 2018 is the first year that same-day registration will be available statewide at early walk-in locations and at precinct locations on election day. So this is not the end. People can still go and vote at the same time.
And you can still use the Power Ballot before you register if you have to do it on the same day. And what's the best way to make use of this tool?
Well, for me personally, I do vote by mail. We talk about vote by mail a lot. And so I like to do my due diligence and research, because sometimes I just have no idea and I don't want to just vote on name recognition. So if you have that luxury and that time to do research while you're voting at home, that's great. But again, you can still use it on your tablet or your smartphone if you do go and want to do some research, last minute research, while you're in the voting booth and making those important decisions.
Okay, so you can use it beforehand or even at the moment of voting.
Absolutely.
Describe for us a little bit about what you'll see when you put in your address where you're registered to vote and what's going to pop up.
So again, a mock-up of your ballot. So you'll have a list of all the gubernatorial candidates, if you're qualified to vote for them, which everybody is, your congressional candidates, depending on which district you're at, first or second, and it goes down the list. So Senate candidates, state Senate candidates, if there's an open seat, or House candidates as well. So again, it just depends on what your district is.
So that's maybe an overlooked but pretty useful tool, is that you don't have to look at a map and figure out which district for a city council or which state Senate district you're in and all of that. This Power Ballot does that for you. It tells you exactly who you're eligible to vote for.
Exactly. And I think what I found and what feedback I've gotten, the most used races that people research is the OHA races, because they just don't get a lot of media attention. There's not a lot of information on TV or the ads that we see, and a lot of times people can't put a face to a name. So this has really helped in that sense. At least that's what people tell me.
And it's really fast too. I took a look at it earlier, and you can go through your entire ballot in less than 30 minutes and really know who you're eligible to vote for. And then you mentioned there's some resources attached to each candidate as much as possible, right?
Mm-hmm. You're right. Their, again, campaign website, if we're able to find it. Their picture, again, sometimes we just can't find anything. Social media pages, so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, if they have these. And candidate questionnaires, if we're able to locate them as well.
So how did this, what's the genesis of this tool? How did it come to be?
Well, in 2014, we had a civic code challenge called Civic Accelerator, kind of the first challenges of its kind. And it was a partnership between us at Common Cause, Hawaii Open Data, and the Campaign Spending Commission. And it brought together developers and coders and just regular everyday citizens. And we're able to break up into teams, brainstorm ideas on how to use data that's available and make it more easily digestible for folks. The emphasis was on campaign spending data, but this one actually came out of it because there was election data available, and the volunteers, they just saw this need. We don't have a voter guide, and there's a plethora of information out there. It just takes time to sort through it. So just to make the process a little less overwhelming, that's where this came from.
What kind of participation have you had from candidates who are on the ballot this year?
We don't reach out to them. This is completely 100% volunteer source. So they spend hours and hours, you know, looking for photos, looking for their candidate websites and things like that, because we are a nonpartisan organization. So just trying to just lay the information out there and voters can make their own decisions.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from voters? Is this a tool that they're finding helpful?
At least that what I've heard, yes, I think they find it helpful. Again, it's for the lower ticket races that people may not be paying as much attention to. There's not TV ads, radio ads, or what have you. So maybe not necessarily for the gubernatorial races or lieutenant governor. People may have already made up their minds. But again, state house, state senate, because there's a lot of open seats this year. And again, especially for OHA, you know, putting a face to a name, I think, is really helpful as well.
Okay, so tell us one more time, how can you access the Power Ballot?
So just log on to a website, so hawaiipowerballot.com. And you just pop in your address and just click away.
And you have to make sure to use the same address that you're registering to vote with, correct?
Correct, because if you're using a different address, a different ballot would pop up, you know, who you're able to vote for. So use the address that you're registered with.
Okay. Anything else you'd like folks listening out there to know?
This is 100% volunteer sourced and based. You know, thank you to our lead developers, Royce Jones, the map guy, Jason Axelson, and Aaron Fujimoto, and all of our volunteers who have sourced this. And if you do see any errors, and we're still constantly working on this application, so please email us, hawaiipowerballot@gmail.com. And if you have any questions, we're happy to field them as well.
All right. Thanks so much for coming in today, Corey.
Thank you very much.
That was Corey Tanita from Common Cause Hawaii speaking with the Conversations Ryan Finnerty. To try and check out the Power Ballot, go to hawaiipowerballot.com, hawaiipowerballot.com.
Put on your mittens and your coat.
Go out and rock the boat.
Get there by car or bus or boat.
Go out and rock the boat.
Email your friends from coast to coast.
Go out and rock the boat.
It's coming down. The next 4 years are up to you. You'll change the world.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki. Providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet. And as usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we're grateful we've got him on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week for us?
Hey, Dave, good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the western sky after sunset. They are joined by Mars in the east around 7 p.m. The moon this week will begin to wane, and we will see a return to dark skies by week's end. Perfect for stargazing.
Something that we have not had in the Stargazer report for a while, something about our moon and also maybe information about its past?
Indeed. Now, last week came the surprise announcement of the existence of a liquid water lake beneath the Martian southern polar cap, discovered by the Mars Express Orbiter. Now, this finding is yet to be confirmed by other sources, but nonetheless, it is a very exciting development in the search for water in the solar system. Another surprise in that search comes from our closest celestial neighbor, the Moon. Planetary scientists have theorized that for a period of millions of years, our own Moon may have been suitable for life.
Now, I remember the discovery of frozen water in some of the craters, but how could it have been suitable for life?
Well, it's theorized that there was a period around 3.5 billion years ago when the Moon was intensely volcanic. It's suspected that there could have been enough gas emitted by these volcanoes to create a dense atmosphere and, of course, liquid water on the surface.
So you're saying, in theory, there could have been life on the Moon at some point?
In theory, yes. In the past, we think the moon possessed a magnetic field similar to the Earth, and so that would have protected the surface from deadly solar radiation. And so it's possible in this period that life may have managed to get a foothold.
And you think there's any chance any kind of life would still be there today?
I would say probably not. Although, when it comes to life in the solar system, I say never. The reality is, though, that the moon as it is today is an incredibly hostile place. That atmosphere and that magnetic field are long gone, and the surface is blasted by radiation, which has basically sterilized the moon for billions of years. But despite all this, though, there may still be evidence left over if these life forms ever existed. And so hopefully in the future, we may be able to actually find some of this evidence.
We know if we do, we'll hear about it on a future Stargazer report. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. We keep Stargazer, by the way, on demand at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
The Queen Emma Summer Palace is one of many stately reminders of the days of Hawaiian royalty in the islands. Built in 1848, the home served as a summer residence of Queen Emma and nowadays houses a museum operated by the Daughters of Hawaii. The home was placed on the National Register of Historic Residences in 1972 and boasts a number of historical artifacts and gifts given by notable foreign heads of state. Among the collection of ali'i feather capes and royal coats of arms, one can find a porcelain vase given by Emperor Meiji and an early slide projector donated by Emperor Napoleon III, and a pristine set of china given to Queen Emma by the British monarch Queen Victoria. While many know this famous residence as the Queen Emma Summer Palace, we ask our listeners to tell us the home's Hawaiian name, and that is Hanai Akamalama. And we did get a winner today, Paul Nielsen of Kaneohe. You had the fastest fingers. We had lots of calls on this, a very popular quiz today. And that is today's backyard quiz. If you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You've probably heard of storm chasers, folks who head into tornadoes to get pictures of the forces at work. But Andrea Ghez is a scientist who's been called a black hole chaser. She's glued to the galaxy at the Keck Observatory, having just arrived in Waimea from California. She chatted with us hours after stepping off the plane last week. She was excited to begin her work up on the Mountain Telescope later that night to take advantage of good weather for peering into the galaxy.
So we're super excited this year. We've been preparing for 2018 for a number of years, and that's because we've been studying the center of the galaxy and discovered stars that orbit the center. And in the early days, those stars enabled us to discover the existence of a supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy. And in fact, that now has given us the best evidence to date that these really exotic objects exist in the universe. But if you keep going with the measurements using the Keck telescopes, you can use these orbiting stars to test Einstein's theory of general relativity in a regime that's never been tested before.
So will you get to do that on your time with Keck?
Yes, we will. In fact, we're entering the third and final phase of this experiment tonight. So we're super excited. This last phase starts now, and we'll go through the beginning of September, and that's when we expect to announce our final results.
So what will you be looking for when you jump on the telescope?
We'll be looking for a difference in how light travels from the star to us. In other words, there are predictions for how we should see the star move in three dimensions. Einstein makes a prediction for that. And what we're looking for is, does the motion of the star and the light that's associated with it conform to those predictions? It's like being in the Wild West. You're exploring territory that has never been explored before. It's important and exciting because there are only four fundamental forces in the universe, and gravity is one. And yet, it's the least of the four. It's the least tested of these four forces. It's ironic because It's the one that we're most familiar with. You throw a ball up, it comes down. And it really drives most of what we see in the universe today. But there's lots of evidence that's accumulating today that suggests that Einstein's theory of how gravity works is fraying at the edges. So we're interested in going into extremes to push and understand how does gravity really work.
So you won't be able to release your findings until later this fall, you think?
Well, this is strategy in terms of science, in terms of when you report your results. So, in fact, there was a big announcement by our competitors. And these two groups, my group and their group, have been doing this experiment for 20 years. They're very similar experiments, and the two groups have very different approaches, philosophies, and, quite frankly, pressures on them. To do this work, you actually need 20 years of data to get a seat at the table. That's a huge investment, and that's why there's only two groups in the world that really do have a seat at the table today. And with this 20 years of data, you get the opportunity now to take the observations over the six-month period of this summer, starting in March, ending in September. And during that that period, you have three key events that you have to measure in order to get the full content, the full information, the full evidence of what the star is providing you in order to understand how gravity works. The first event happened in April. The second event happened in May, so we captured both of them, and now we're just beginning. In fact, tonight we'll be on to start this third phase of the measurements. So my group's strategy is you wait. You get all the evidence. This is a hard measurement. There are a lot of ways to go wrong. It's an important measurement. The results are tremendously important and exciting, but we're going to wait until all the evidence is in before we share where we are.
So when you say there are two teams, and this is kind of a race, and you've been doing this for 20 years, does one side have to lose? I mean, is it a matter of who gets to this destination first and gets their findings printed and gets the credit?
Well, it's interesting in terms of how scientists view the importance of getting there first. So I guess our strategy has been it's really important to get it right. So rather than get caught up in the race for first, focus on paying attention to making the measurements and developing the analysis tools that you really need in order to believe what you're learning about the universe. This is not the first, as I say, rodeo that we've been to with this competing group, and I would say that neither group loses for having two groups. We always get further. The two groups see things differently. We try things differently. We have different points of view. And like in everything in life, when you have two different points of view, you end up in a place that is far better than either group could achieve on their own.
And your group is the UCLA Galactic Center Group?
That's who we are, and we've been working at Keck Observatories for the last 23 years, and it's just been an amazing ride.
And who's your competition?
And the competition is led by Reinhard Genzel from the Max Planck Institute.
And so you've got this great opportunity. I think we've got a window of some pretty decent weather for a while. I have been told that when you view, you know, the galaxy, that it's kind of like a funhouse mirror, and you have to kind of make corrections to make sure what you're looking at is right, is spot on.
Yeah. So, in fact, we have two things that we have to pay attention to in terms of why we can get a view of the center of the galaxy that wasn't possible to get before us. One is that we've developed new techniques for using the Keck telescope in the early days, and today we have much more sophisticated ways of doing that. And the key is taking the blurring effects out of the atmosphere. Sometimes people tell me I take a twinkle out of stars. But using these techniques that we develop, we can get the sharpest images of the center of the galaxy from any place, either the ground or space. And using that technology and to correct for the atmosphere, we look in the infrared. This is light that has a wavelength that's just longward of what your eye detects. It's where your TV remote control works. And the advantage there is that it can penetrate all the dust that resides in the plane of our galaxy. So our galaxy is a flattened disc-like plane. There's lots of stars, but there's also lots of dust I'm from Los Angeles. I have a very clear appreciation for what dust does. It's like smog. It prevents light from getting through if the light has a wavelength that's about the size of the dust particle.
So I have to ask, though, we might not have smog, but we have VOG. Does that mess up
your
viewing?
We're hoping that the VOG isn't going to be a problem. We have been getting great data in recent days, so we're hoping that it holds up tonight as well.
Oh, but what if it doesn't then?
Well, that's we plan for that, in fact. We think a lot about, in our experimental design, we plan for weather. So that's why we're not on every night. We're on every three or five nights, because typically a typical storm, of course this year has been quite unusual, a typical storm lasts a few days. So in terms of our planning of our observations, we think not only of the ideal condition, what kinds of measurements you would make under those ideal conditions, but also the reality of weather.
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed for your team.
Thanks. Well, send us good weather thoughts.
And I understand that you have a member of your team, Devin Chu, who's from Hilo.
Yes, we do. We are really privileged to be working with Devin Chu as a graduate student on the group. He's done some fabulous work looking at the properties of the star that we're watching go around the center of the galaxy. And in particular, he's looked to understand whether or not this star is a single star or whether or not it's his companion. And that's interesting both in terms of understanding how stars form in this really hostile, violent environment, as well as just being a test or a probe of how gravity works. So he's doing great, and we love having a local on the team. We're very, very fortunate.
Well, it's pretty trippy stuff, and you guys are pioneers. My hat's off to you.
Thanks so much for your time.
That was Andrea Ghez, who will be spending the next couple of months stargazing from the Big Island's Keck Telescope, doing groundbreaking research related to gravity and black holes in our universe. We have to go, but we'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. What do you think about Honolulu's latest efforts to rein in vacation rentals? Does it go too far? Think it doesn't go far enough? Here's a number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook or at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.